John Weidman came to the attention of Sondheim because he'd written a play, and the play was sent by Weidman to Hal Prince, who thought it could be musicalized. And one moment it was just John Weidman sitting up in Yale, and the next minute he's in a room collaborating with Sondheim. He's a simply wonderful man. Nothing bad can be said about him. He's the Bernadette Peters of men. This is John Weidman. James Lapine has always described himself, and I think entirely accurately, as a soft reactor. So he can hear something like Move On or Color and Light and say, that was nice. Rather than Hal Prince, who leapt about, my God, how great. Indeed, James is a quiet reactor. James won the Pulitzer Prize with Steve for Sunday in the Park with George. Together, they created the show Passion and, of course, Into the Woods. They are, to me, wedded together as John is, just as inseparable artists and invaluable at this point in our lives. As they advance the theater, they open up the possibilities by exploring the underbelly of what we all think and what we all feel. Of course, John is the author of the book to Assassins and Bounce and, of course, Pacific Overtures in 1976. Correct. Here's James Lapine. Yo! Hey, here's Sondheim. How's your health?
I'm an old man.
I'm fine. This is exhilarating.
Is it?
It's wonderful.
Do you feel proud of yourself today?
I feel proud that so many people want to perform the songs.
And to listen to them. James, you were introduced to Steve Howe.
There was a producer named Lewis Allen who I had approached about a show idea, and he introduced me to Steve. And
a cool million, wasn't that?
A cool million, right, and Nathaniel West novella, which...
Did you actually work on it together?
No. I brought it to Steve, and he looked at it and said it was
well,
too...
Well, it was because it was only, that novel is an American Depression version of Candide. It's the same story, really. And Candide had just been done a few years earlier, which James, I believe, had never seen. Hello? Oh, sorry. Hello? Okay. Okay now?
There we go.
Okay. A Cool Million, which is this novel, by Nathaniel West, is the Candide story. It's a Horatio Alger story, but it's really, you know, the innocent who gets taken advantage of by the cruel world. But it's written, you know, it takes place in Depression America. And James brought it to me, and I thought it'd make a wonderful musical, except for the fact that Candide itself had just been done recently. And so we decided to try to find something else.
How did you go about that, finding something out?
Well, it was interesting because James came from a non-Broadway background. I was brought up to, you get a story idea, and then you just sort of start at the beginning, and then you write the story, and then you finish it. And James came from a much more free-thinking background. And so we just, he said, let's just get to know each other and talk about whatever movies and plays we like and see what our, how our temperaments match. I had seen a play that he'd written and directed called 12 Dreams, and I was knocked out by it, and I wanted to meet him. I wanted to work with him, but I was too shy to write and ask. And so it was very, very fortunate that within a couple of months, and coincidental, that Lou Allen called and got us together. But James, just coming from a visual background particularly, he brought over photographs and just visual ideas, and we'd just spread them out on the floor and see whether the ideas would abut. And I thought, oh, it's so avant-garde, it's so youthful, and I'm so old, and I just want a story, just tell me a story. And then one night he mentioned a piece he had done on Gertrude Stein, I think it's a three-page play, yes, right. Called Photograph, mm-hmm. that he had done off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway.
Way off-Broadway.
And it had involved a lot of visual things, including a painting by George Seurat. And he also asked me what kind of musical I would like to write. And I said, I want to write a theme and variations. And he said, what do you mean? And I showed him a magazine that's published in France, no longer, I think, called Bizarre. And this magazine, one issue was devoted entirely to the Mona Lisa. It was Mona Lisa jokes. It was Mona Lisa reproductions, cut, repasted, Mona Lisa brushed with steel wool. It was just 50 pages of variations on Mona Lisa. And the two ideas sort of abutted. And we started to talk about the Seurat painting, and James said, you realize that nobody is looking at anybody else in that picture. There are 48 or 50 people, nobody. And he said, I wonder why. And we started to think how it looked like a stage set, and then he said the key sentence. He said, of course, the main character is missing. I said, who? He said, the painter. And that's what started the whole idea of somebody who controls and makes a world. And that's, it was like a light bulb going off. We just, or I did anyway, I just knew I wanted to write it.
When Weidman showed up...
Is that a fair assessment? He's always correcting my memory. We were probably talking about the Annunciation, but I...
When Weidman showed up, Steve, he showed up through, I think, Hal, right?
Yeah.
And he showed up with a play that he had written. First of all, just John, how did you come to write a play on that subject?
Well, I wrote a play at all because I was a second-year law student, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life if I did not become an attorney, which I had not at that point decided I did not intend to become. And I thought if I had a piece of paper and a pencil, I could sit in the Yale Law Library and write a play, which I did. And it was based on I was interested in Japanese history, which I had majored in, which was a weird thing to do, back in the 60s at college. So the weirdness began... when I was an undergraduate, so I wrote this play, and Hal liked it. Was very intrigued by the idea, even then, of using Japanese theatrical techniques to tell this story from the Japanese point of view. This is before it became a musical. I waited while Hal got a little light music up, and then we aimed for a production of this straight play on Broadway. I was coming into town for rehearsals until one day my phone rang in New Haven. It was Hal saying that Boris Aronson, who was supposed to design it, was having trouble. We couldn't figure it out. And there was a pause, and he said, we think it ought to be a musical. And I thought that was his polite way of saying, I'm not going to do your play, goodbye. But he said he would give it to Steve Sondheim, and then we'd all go to work. And I was later told by Hal that giving it to Steve Sondheim was not such an easy process in this case. But eventually, that's how the collaboration started.
Well, now, it would seem to me that it could be said that Jerome Weidman, your father, basically is responsible for your collaboration with Steve because of his friendship with Hal Prince?
Yes, no question about it. My dad wrote the books for a couple of shows along with George Abbott for Fiorello and Tenderloin, which were produced in the very late 50s and early 60s by Griffith and Prince, Bobby Griffith and Hal Prince. And Hal had been in our living room when I was a relatively little kid a couple of times, which is what gave me the chutzpah to send him a letter at his office in New York. So mm-hmm. Thank you, Dad.
Yes. Did when Weidman came in and started to work with you, did you feel, I found a fella I can really work with? I like this guy.
Oh, sure, right away. John's the best company in the world, as well as a first-rate fella and a good writer too. So it was easy. Once I didn't want to write songs for it. When I read the play, I thought, it doesn't sing, it needs background music. And I said to Hal, I could write some background music for you, but I don't think there are songs here. And he said, well, why don't you live with it a little bit? And I did, and over a period of, it took me about a month, and then I saw a way into it. Mm-hmm. But from then on, my memory is that it was really fun to write.
I was having a
moderately easy time.
Yes, I mean, I was having a somewhat odd experience since I had been fans of Hal's and Steve's through the show which immediately preceded my show, which was Pacific Overtures. So it was an odd transition to be part of the team rather than somebody with a ticket in his hand looking at the show. But no, I remember it as a show that wrote relatively easily. Memories can be.
One of the things you told me a while ago was to read the Admirals. There are three sections that you really can't hear the words. In other words, Steve was writing words that couldn't be heard, like rock music.
Yeah, there's
rock lyrics.
There are sections of the Admirals number where the Admirals deliberately overlap, and you are not supposed to be able to understand anything they're saying. But if you look at those lyrics, they are as good as the lyrics in the rest of the number. The attention to detail is remarkable when you look at it on the page.
Steve, some people say that you're a procrastinator. Some people say that you are a diligent and specific writer. What are you?
Well, I certainly am diligent because I was trained to be diligent by Oscar Hammerstein. As far as procrastination, I have to make excuses for myself. I mean, the whole last section of Follies, for example, was not written until we were in rehearsal. But it wasn't because I was procrastinating, because nobody knew how to get out of the fantasy sequence, and until we could decide how to get out of the fantasy, I couldn't write into the fantasy, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll leave it to my accusers. If James and John both are, to use the word again, meticulously on time. They are. Mm-hmm. If they say, I'll give you the scene tomorrow, it comes in tomorrow. And I'll have to leave it to them to complain.
I don't think Steve procrastinates. I think it can be slow sometimes, but I don't think that's procrastinating. I don't think you're ever not working or thinking about it. Just sometimes it takes you a while to get where you want to go, which I'd rather have that than something that's... You said to me once, do you want a Tuesday or do you want it good? So, you know, I always will opt for good first. You know. But you also can write very, very fast.
Yeah, when necessary.
Yeah.
So give me an example, Steve.
Well, at the FASO, Sending the Clowns, we needed a song for Glynis. It was the fourth week of our 4.5-week rehearsal period before we went out of town. And we had cast Glynis because she seemed right for the part, but we assumed that she had a small, silvery voice, that I should give her as little stuff to sing as possible so that it wouldn't strain the voice. And we discovered during rehearsal that she sang very well. And so I had written nothing for her in the second act, and Hal said, would you write something? I had planned a song for Frederick, the hero in the bedroom scene, for him to sing to her when they decide they can't get together. And Hal said, let me redirect it. I said, the thrust is his. I don't know how I can put a song in there. And Hal said, let me redirect it. And I went down, and he had redirected the scene without changing the dialogue, where the emotional thrust came from her and not from Frederick. And I wrote the song in a day and a half. Mm-hmm. That may sound impressive, but there's a reason that so many good songs in musical comedy history have been written out of town. Once you know what the shape of the show is, where the weaknesses are, where the strengths and the weaknesses of the performers are, what they can do well and what they can do not so well, what makes them self-conscious, what seems to come easily, it becomes much easier to write songs for them. It's obvious. I have often stated, humorously, that I don't really want to write the score till the show is cast and rehearsed. Because then I could... you could write it right away. But, you know, the woods are full of famous songs that were written out of town. Anyway, but I can write fast when I know exactly who I'm writing for.
Steve, an interviewer once asked you, why do you write lyrics? And your reply was, and I quote you, because I have to. What does that mean?
That wasn't me.
Well, it was. Ned Roram.
Well... Censor, censor, censor. I can't imagine why I said that. The fact is, I was, because I wanted to be so much like Oscar, I wanted to write lyrics because that's what he did. And I always liked writing music, but it wasn't to be a composer. When I met Oscar, what I wanted to be was a songwriter, and that meant writing lyrics. And so I just fell into the habits. It's not very pleasant work, I find, but I would rather argue with myself than with a lyricist.
If Oscar Hammerstein were alive, had been living through this period, which of your shows do you think he might have enjoyed the most, and which of your shows do you think he might have detested?
My guess is that he would have loved both Sunday in the Park with George and Into the Woods. And my guess is, well, I don't know. His daughter, Alice, once said to me that the show of mine he would have hated, and I'm not so sure she's right, is Sweeney Todd, because she saw it as being a sour, dark view of humanity, and Oscar, as we all know, did not have that view of humanity. So I don't know whether he would have detested that or not. Oscar was not a detester. He was much too generous. He was one of the very few generous people I've ever met in the profession. I was using
the word humorously.
Yeah, I know. No, but I mean, I don't think he would have disapproved of any kind of show that any writer writes out of his heart, out of something he wants to do, because that's what he did.
I think he would have had a rollicking good time at Forum.
Yes, he would have. That's very much his kind of humor. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How lucky you were.
Yes.
To have that sudden exposure as a young man in Bucks County, and there is Oscar Hammerstein. Mm-hmm. You've often said that if he had been a proctologist, you would have become a proctologist.
The word was geologist, but it's okay.
But Steve, you understand, I changed it humorously.
Well, we're both Jewish. My son, the doctor, that's why. You never hear my son, the geologist.
James, have you ever had an encounter with Steve so unpleasant that you didn't talk for a while?
No. No, I actually don't. I remember once, I think when we were doing Sunday, wasn't there something, it was an article or a gossip piece saying we were not talking to each other, we were fighting or something?
And it was somebody who hadn't even interviewed me, right, exactly.
Yeah,
and
it was good for a laugh. We get along.
No, I have one guilty memory of an unpleasant moment. James is somebody who likes to try, as a director, likes to try things out. And being the writer, he can afford, he can often fiddle with his own lines. And he was trying to work out different endings for Sunday in the Park with George, when George revisits the island and then all the ghosts come back and he finds himself there. And George, and James was trying to find some way of conveying that important piece of information, which is of metaphysical information, that the past informs the present. And I'd liked what he'd done so much, and I went down there, and he was doing something different, and I got real grumpy, and he looked at me, and he stopped, and he went right back to the old thing, and I realized that what I had done was I had stopped his creative flow, which is, you know, criminal to do. And particularly since the director has to invent on his feet in front of a cast. And I never did it again. And he was not angry at me, but he looked hurt, and he was, I think. You don't even remember it.
He remembers. Weidman, I can't. This is silly to even ask you, because I can't imagine you having a vicious fight or even a conflict with anybody, even Roy Cohn.
I think, you know, it's interesting. Steve and I have worked on and off together over a long period of time on very different kinds of material. And the only time I think there has ever been a tension between us when we're working creatively is when Steve feels that I am bailing out on something, a first impulse of mine, because somebody's had another view of it or a different opinion. And it's part of the way we work together. And for me, it's a useful presence because I feel
it. What do you mean, someone outside?
Well, if we finish something, you're working with a director or somebody handed it to somebody to read and an opinion comes back, or you're in the rehearsal process and somebody wants something changed. And you just described me as the world's nicest guy. I think I am sometimes inclined to listen too closely to other people's criticism, and not so much to take it to heart, but to want to respond to it constructively in some way, as opposed to sometimes simply saying, you know what, I hear what you're saying, but our way is the way we want it done. Mm-hmm.
I tend to be the same way, and when I say to John, don't give up so easily, I'm also saying it to myself. Mm-hmm. This is one of the differences between them. That's not a problem that James has. He considers everything, but he has very... He has great confidence.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about assassins.
You can lose your way. You can really lose your way if you're not careful.
Tell me about assassins and John.
I don't know what to say. You mean how it came about?
Yeah.
Well, it came about because a fellow named Charlie Gilbert had written a sort of musical play. It's not really. It's more of an outline. Called Assassins, which I happened to read when I was serving on a panel for a musical theater production company that Stuart Ostra had started. Mm-hmm. And many, many years, and I thought it was just a great idea for a show, from the title. Mm-hmm. And the show itself was problematical. It was about a Vietnam veteran who comes back bitterly and becomes an assassin. But there was a presence of the presidential assassins in the piece. And many years later, John and I wanted to write something together, and I suggested, he'd come to me with an idea, which I didn't quite get, and so I suggested this to him, and I just said the word assassins, and he had exactly the same reaction I'd had. Just the word itself suggested something. Mm-hmm. And so I tracked down Charlie Gilbert through Ted Chapin, and asked him if I could have permission to use his idea without using his material. And to my surprise and delight, he said yes. So we went to work on it. But one of the most exciting evenings of my life was we talked about it a lot, and then John went home and wrote. And unlike in Pacific Overtures, instead of sending me scenes, he'd say, listen, let me just get another scene written. We had first started, as a matter of fact, it wasn't just going to be presidential assassins. It was going to be assassins from ancient history mm-hmm. to the present. There was too many. So then we decided that it will be American assassins. There were too many. I mean, because, the assassination of Harvey Milk, John wrote a scene about that. And so we decided finally just to do presidential assassins. But for some reason, he was reluctant to show me the scenes, and yet he sounded happy with what he was writing. And eventually, he sent me, which I've never had this in a collaboration before, he sent me the entire piece. And I read it in the country, and it was brilliant. That's the only time I've ever received something whole. And we've never talked about what that impulse that you had
did
was.
Did he call you? And
yeah, he did.
Yeah, sure.
What did he say? John, this is Steve?
That's a highly likely way in which the conversation went. I don't remember. I certainly remember that I was thrilled that he liked it so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had had Assassins, for me, is the most satisfying writing experience I've ever had. I mean, once we got past that first meeting, which Steve described, we met sort of once a week, and we just talked. And there was some research and some reading to do, but we really stayed as far away as possible from any kind of topic sentence that would package what it was we thought we were writing about. And we really, it's an awful cliche, and I wish I could say it otherwise, but we really sort of let these characters come to life and talk back to us. And I realized at some point about halfway through the process that I was 17 when Kennedy was assassinated, and it was the first really devastating experience of loss that I ever had. I went to Washington for the funeral, and that initial impulse that Steve, the reaction to the word, was about trying to deal with the kind of pain which is created by these apparently arbitrary acts. And all that, I mean, that may have had something to do with why I held onto the material until as much of that could get poured into it as possible.
But also because he was experimenting with every different kind of style.
Yeah.
I mean, what was bubbling clearly in his head was to go from something silly to something melodramatic to something sentimental to something dramatic, blah, 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 to end. And I think it's just as well that I didn't get in there and say, is this scene supposed to be funny? I mean, so there was no discouragement. So he was able to bubble ahead with no censorship, and I think that was... And that's unusual. I like to work closely with a collaborator. I worked that way with John on Pacific Overtures, you know, developing as you go along and developing as you go along.
I think that the song called Bounce, which, of course, went through the phase of being called Wise Guys and then Gold and then Bounce. But I've looked at that song, which I love, Steve, love it, as a kind of new version of Pick Yourself Up.
Yeah, well, it is. It's about America's resilience. That's what the show is about. It's about. We decided that should be the central idea at that time.
Where do we stand on it now?
John and I, we're talking about it. We wanted to let it marinate for a year.
Because it's
just something we like a lot, and we've never done it the way we really want to do it. And so I said, so let's wait for a while and we'll talk about it again. So we're talking about it again.
In the Frogs, and I'll let you tell the rhyme,
but
when I first heard it, I was in a car in the rain in California. I just laughed out loud. And the rhyme, which you'll tell, just use the word, is va-va-voom.
Oh, you mean it's in the song called Hades.
Hades, which is a new song.
Yes, it's a new song. I was a little worried about using that. It's a slightly old-fashioned expression, but I thought it'd be perfect for Pluto, and particularly...
Tell me the lines.
I don't remember the lyrics at this
moment.
No,
just that one...
It has an ordinary rhyme.
Bloom?
Gloom. There's something about fire and gloom. Don't ask me to remember lyrics in public. It's not a hard word to rhyme, I got to tell you, John. Voom is not a hard word to rhyme.
I know, but va-va-voom. In other words, how wonderful it is in Hades. That's the point of the song. And by way of saying that, Steve chose va-va-voom, which knocked me out.
Yeah.
Also, Steve, your use of the word chuckleheads, which was a word at that period.
You know, in Follies, I remember that, in Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. Yeah. Well, you know, when you're writing a period piece, you want to somehow... I have a book that's quite hard to find, American Thesaurus of Slang, and it was last published in 1937, so the slang is not very up-to-date. But if you're going to write a show about the Ziegfeld Follies, it's very useful.
That was just perfect. Yeah. Okay, Isaiah, thank you. We have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, first of all, Steve, to get away from collaboration with these two fellows for a moment, about the future of Sweeney Todd as a film. I've heard something about it, and Thomas.
It's got a really wonderful script by John Logan, which I had a little input into, but it's essentially his way of telling the story, and it adheres very much to the show, but it has an idea. Not just a cinematic idea, but and I don't want to give it away, but a structural idea. And Sam Mendes is going to direct it. And there's nothing else to say. That's if it ever gets made and if it ever gets on. But, I mean, at the moment it is it is in the hands of an actor who we hope will play Sweeney Todd.
It's so interesting to me, and this is a somewhat personal observation, that Sam Mendes can come back again after the Wise Guys experience, and everything's under control.
Well, it's an entirely different experience. First of all, Wise Guys was a workshop, and unfortunately, Sam was directing his first movie, American Beauty, and at the timing was just wrong, so that at a period when he thought he would be through with the movie, He wasn't. So he went into the rehearsal of the workshop feeling slightly discombobulated. And so I think that was one of the things that set off the experience as being, although, you know, that workshop has a reputation of being some kind of disaster. It wasn't. It was a piece that when we put it on in the workshop, we could start to see what was wrong with it and what we wanted to fix and what we wanted to do. There was then an unfortunate litigation problem with the rights and that sort of thing, which sort of put the kibosh. Well, you know, but nevertheless, it was not this catastrophic experience. It was not a happy experience because various things just didn't come together during the rehearsal, during that workshop period. That's all. But the movies, you know, movie is something that Sam worked on with John Logan that he's enthusiastic about.
James and John, do you know that in the month of May of this year, the first of three volumes of CDs will come out with Steve singing his own songs?
I've heard so.
Did you know that?
I guinea pigged it. I said, I'll just give it to John. And I said, I know he likes me and he'll be really nice. And I said,
you've heard?
Yes, I've heard some.
Well, I'm told it's just wonderful. Steve has been recording for years, and there are three volumes. Yes.
No. I had a great friend named John Ryan. He had two pianos and a lot of money and a great setup for recording. And so everything I wrote, I recorded at his house, up until the beginning of, or almost halfway through, Little Night Music, at which point Johnny got divorced and the recording equipment went elsewhere. So these are all recordings up until then. Now, I've made a few since then. I record a lot of stuff at Hal's house, because he would give a party before going to rehearsal with each show, and we would record it there. But the audio is so bad that they cannot be released. There's no balance between piano and voice, and these are not things I've been recording recently. These are things that date back a long time.
That's what I said.
Oh, okay.
You've been recording for years.
I've been recording for years. Okay.
So this one will make Steve one of the most recorded great composers of all time. I guess Harold Arlen.
Wait till you hear me sing. Hey.
Harold Arlen was recorded.
Harold Arlen could sing.
A lot.
As well as write.
Be quiet over there. Johnny Mercer. But this man will be represented by three volumes of his playing the piano and his singing his songs. And I think we should all know that and be so happy and anticipatory.
Advance orders out in the lobby.
Go ahead.
It's on a label called PS Classics, which is they do the beautiful work that they, for example, on The Frogs.
An amazing scene.
And on Assassins.
Tommy Krasker is the guy's name.
That's the guy. And so it'll be a classy set to look at.
And of course to treasure. My thanks to Weidman. My thanks to James. And my love extended, my lifelong adoration and admiration extended to Steve Sondheim.
Thank you all.